I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend.
Please welcome to the stage 23andMe's CEO, Anne Wojcicki, Sprout Pharmaceuticals' Cindy Whitehead, and Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary.
Hi, welcome to all of you. I wanted to start, since this is a conference about innovation, I wanted to start with what I feel like are maybe two separate routes that the two of you are coming from. And obviously, you have been kind of building and developing your company for a long time. Cindy, you guys acquired a drug. Mm-hmm. What are the pros and cons of doing that? Like, why come in and say, you know what, we're going to buy this drug, we're going to go after it, when it had already had a slightly turbulent history? And for those of you who don't know, we're talking about Addy, which Cindy does not like being called the female Viagra, but that is probably how most people know.
True. And we'll talk about that.
Yes.
But in terms of why come into it, in my case, prior to this, I founded a company that had a drug in male sexual health. So I was watching this science emerge, watching the enthusiasm. Finally, we're going to have a treatment for women. And when another company turned to walk away from the development program, it really struck me that it wasn't a scientific decision. It was a decision based on a societal narrative, a narrative around female sexuality, where we really do reduce, I think, all things in the bedroom for men to biology, and all things in the bedroom for women to psychology. And in fact, both things are at play for both genders. And I think that, you know, a conversation needed to happen for women with a biological dysfunction, and there was the science there. So,
and it was easy to go in and buy in that way, as opposed to sort of do the development from the ground up?
You know, well, in our case, I think it needed a champion. So we still did a lot of the scientific work. There was still gaps that needed to be completed. But I think that the champion coming in, really fully understanding the science, and I spent a year doing diligence. So diligence not only in terms of the science, the regulatory pathway, but also really just talking to women who had the condition and really understanding it from their vantage point, because I think it is a condition that is really poorly understood.
From your standpoint, you grew this thing, and it's been, I think by your own admission, a somewhat rocky road over the past couple of years. What's the draw to sort of going out on your own and building a company from the ground up?
Well, we didn't really have a choice. So I think I would have, if there was something that we could have acquired. I mean, I think that there's, I think probably in both our cases, it sounds like there's an end goal, and you achieve that whatever way you can. And I'm always open to acquisition. I'm always open to other ideas. In the case for 23andMe, we wanted to bring genetic information to the consumer. And so we did lots of partnerships. So we partner with Illumina. They make the chip for us. We partner with LabCorp. They actually run it for us. We made a very conscious decision that it was better to not use our capital to build a lab, and it was much better to partner. And I think part of it is, as a startup, you try to think about how you are de-risking as much as possible so that you are actually making sure that you have cash. So when we got our FDA letter in 2013, we had the cash to survive, because if we had had to raise money after getting a warning letter, it would have been a very different situation.
What's the right role for a consumer? Because obviously what you do is direct to consumer. You guys have done a lot of outreach. There was a very big marketing campaign about sort of getting the drug approved. Are we like good judges of our own health? Are we good judges of what we can understand?
Well, one of my favorite papers is this JAMA paper that came out. There's a JAMA paper in 1961 that surveyed physicians, and they asked physicians how many of them would tell their patient if they had a cancer diagnosis. And in 1961, 90% of physicians said they would not tell their patient if they had a cancer diagnosis. So if you think about how much society has actually changed from that moment of when your doctor wouldn't even tell you if you had a disease, to the era of actually when pregnancy tests, there's a really interesting history around pregnancy tests, when it was hypothesized that no sane woman wanted to be pregnant, and they'd potentially kill themselves if they found out they were pregnant alone, they needed the supervision of a doctor. And so society has really evolved to understand that we're not all as incapable or fearful as we might think, and that we're actually capable of actually making healthcare choices. And I think where I'm most excited about is this: the fact that there is this consumer health revolution, and that consumers are more and more standing up and saying they want to take control. And I think the fact, what I'm so proud about with the FDA approval, the FDA clearance that we just got, is that the FDA came out and said specifically that we believe in many cases there are reasons that you should get genetic information. You do not need a physician or a genetic counselor, and it should be direct to consumer. And to me, that it's obviously significant for the company, but it's almost more significant for the entire industry, the fact that you actually have a group like the FDA saying that this is sort of this new era, information is going to become more and more accessible to individuals.
And yet it's a somewhat modified version now, the approval. I mean, can you explain kind of what they signed off on in terms of risk profiles, et cetera?
Sure. One of the things that we had to do with the FDA was to prove and to show that consumers actually can understand this information. So we started first with the carrier status information. So that's tests like cystic fibrosis. And so we wanted to make sure that customers could understand what a cystic fibrosis report meant for them and understand relatively complicated ideas like residual risk, which means that even if I tested you for these 30, 40 mutations, there's still a long tail of potential mutations that we did not test for. So there's some very small element of risk, but we can never tell you that there's no risk. And customers are able to understand that. So we have a limited amount of the health information that has come back, but it's at least opened the door for a pathway for us to go and get future approvals on additional disease content. So things like the Alzheimer's report, the breast cancer report, pharmacogenetics, meaning the drug response. So all kinds of other reports have that potential to come back now that we've at least established a pathway and a communication.
I would just say I echo and I share this enthusiasm. I think that the patient voice is becoming the center of the conversation. I think who knows better than us the experience that we're living, how we're dealing with something if we don't have a treatment, how we would define success. And I would say the FDA themselves have gone a long way to recognize this and unmet needs. So they have a program called patient-focused drug development. And in areas they identify as key unmet needs, they basically open their doors and invite in panels of patients and experts to talk through conditions. That was, I think, instrumental with us. They opened their doors for 2 days to the public. And really heard directly and asked questions with women. What are you doing today? How would you define success in this condition? And with experts, how should we be measuring this? What instrument should we be using? I think that really does promote understanding and allows us to have an open mind to science, particularly in conditions that are stigmatized.
Well, and yet your drug also does come now with a black box warning, yes. And there, you know, women cannot drink alcohol.
Right.
So how do you square that and say, I trust you to weigh in on drug development and tell me what you need, but then it goes out there in the market. Do you as a CEO sit there and think, ooh, is everyone gonna do this right?
No, I think that you characterize in all drugs, you characterize the benefits and the risks. So I think the participation in the conversation promotes disease state awareness and understanding. But drugs inherently are gonna be scientifically measured. You're gonna be held to rigor to articulate what the benefits and risks are. And then you're ultimately gonna turn that decision-making over to patients and their healthcare provider. You know, all medicine today is really shared decision making. You decide, is that risk worth it to me? Is that benefit worth it to me? With an informed intermediary. And I think that is the right thing to happen. I think in this case in particular, when I say what was the impetus to get into this for me, is I was troubled by why we weren't able to characterize benefit and risk in a drug and turn over that decision to a woman and her healthcare provider to make that call for herself.
One of the things that I was watching Kai do last night when he sort of opened this up, he and Kate Betts were talking about kind of where inspiration strikes and how often that does not happen in the office. I know Kai gets up and runs before dawn because he's a masochist weirdo. I do not do that. I'm wondering for the two of you, where are you your most creative? Where does the good stuff come to you?
I think it's kind of random. It's random a little bit for me. When I think about when we started 23andMe, or the creativity, and when you're trying to problem solve, in some ways it almost seems so natural. When you're solving a problem that's for yourself, in some way, then it seems very obvious and it's very natural, and the creativity comes from something that is not necessarily, like, I'm not trying to understand the full problem. Like, I really want 23andMe for me. And I have this vision, like, it's just so obvious to me. Like, I have this vision for what it should look like. I have a vision for how we can actually change healthcare. And so a lot of that creativity comes from this vision of a world that I can imagine, and a lot of that also comes from seeing what the problems are. So you see and really understand those problems. And in some ways, just being allowed, like having some level of free time and some ability to ponder a world, it's almost more that, like, rather than the actual physical space that you're in, is that ability to actually mentally enable yourself to say there could be any world of possibilities.
Do you ever have time to do that?
Well, I think that's part of the beauty of Silicon Valley, is that people genuinely encourage you to think crazy. And that, it's the hypothesis that there's nothing that is sort of sacred that can't be changed. Like, even I always joke, when we went to go get my son's passport, we went to the passport office and we had to wait, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And during that time period, Sergey, my ex-husband, he ended up like rearranged. He was like, this office infrastructure is just all wrong. You can do the entire passport system in a different way. And when we sat down with the agent, he was like, I have a whole new plan for you. And there's something beautiful in that thinking, that like every problem, you know, it's almost this constant desire to optimize and think about everything in a new way. And that, I think that's what I really enjoy being in Silicon Valley, is that people look at the world and see, how could you potentially imagine things in a different way? And so there's a lot of space and creativity in that community to say, like, wow, like, if healthcare sucks today, why don't we just like try doing it totally different, and what could work? And that's where I think a lot of creativity comes from, being able to have that freedom of thought.
I want to come back to some Silicon Valley questions in a second, yeah. But I'm curious where your ideas come from?
I think I'm fed by surrounding myself with others, right? So in this process in particular, I think it was being uniquely invited in by women to share some of their really most private issues.
Well, how does that work? What does that mean?
Well, you know, I think that along the way, so the spark of doing this, right, the reason to do it, was really fueled by reinforcement, I think, from others who came forward and said, yes, please, do this, and here's why. And so, you know, when I get out of the office and get opportunity to spend time with women who've written in letters or couples or whoever will share that, I think that's where maybe, I don't know that it's the creativity, but it's the reinforcement of the mission and the why that comes, that you know, pushes you on to, I think, the new idea, the next thought, et cetera.
So, Anne, to go back to what you were saying about Silicon Valley, I noticed when I was out there reporting a story earlier this year, everyone was using the, like, make a difference, change the world phraseology to me. Someone was like, I'm changing the world, I drive a Tesla. Okay, maybe. Does the Valley get out over its skis, particularly with respect to regulators and kind of other parts of the government framework, business framework? I feel like that is a pretty contentious relationship, and I wonder if there's circular thinking within Silicon Valley that maybe inhibits some innovation.
I think Silicon Valley has a beauty in being unrealistic. and I think that there's something, like, who, like, when we were all kids, like, did you ever really think you could start your own rocket company? Like, it's kind of crazy. Like, the fact that Elon Musk has started a rocket company and a car company, like, it's pretty insane. So I think that, I think that there's something beautiful about ignoring all realistic constraints. And I do that frequently with our team. I say, imagine a world where there's unlimited resources and there's no regulatory landscape. Like, what would we do? And I think it's really important for teams to think about that. Mm-hmm. And then laws are meant to be changed. Like, they're meant to evolve. They're meant to adapt to society. I mean, look at Uber and what they're doing. Like, it's meant to evolve. And so if you just think about the world of possibilities with, like, the existing infrastructure and how it's meant to be, you're massively limiting yourself. And I think that might be part of it. It's not as much that people, like, I do think that there's a disconnect, and I think Silicon Valley doesn't necessarily understand a lot about politics and how to communicate. But I think it's really good at imagining a world of, like, what makes the most sense, and then how can we actually work then to try to change policies. And I think it's really important to realize, like, laws are meant to evolve. They're not meant to be fixed.
So what would you do to change about the regulatory landscape? You've both gone up against the FDA in particular.
What would I change?
we only have 30 minutes.
Yeah, no, you got 30 minutes. Come on.
You know, I think that dialogue, more open dialogue, I think, with sponsors. They have made efforts. There's a new program around transparency, having these opportunities for checkpoints along the way. You know, often you go in, you resubmit. There's a six-month window. For a long time, that can go quiet. And I think that it would be valuable to continue to have dialogue at every step along the way so that you're having an opportunity to explain data, to work through data, to look at what else might need to be considered, et cetera. I think there are sort of information gaps at moments in time and process.
I've thought a lot about this. So I think that with the information systems that we have, like with the fact that the world is connected, I think clinical trials and how they function today don't make a ton of sense. And I think that this idea that there's a black and white difference between a drug being approved and then it's either not approved or then it's approved. And the reality is like Tylenol has added on additional warnings. Advil has added on additional warnings. The reality is that we're going to keep learning about all therapies and all medications over time. And so having a distributed sort of massive phase 4 network where we're continuously learning, to me, is super important. So how is it that you can actually get drugs out faster? So can you actually have a modified, like you do your safety studies, are there ways, especially for rare diseases mm-hmm. and severe indications of unmet need, can you actually get them out much faster and then have a really extensive phase 4 kind of monitoring so you can actually see the real life? And to your point about how you said it before, like, well, how are people really taking it? Do they hold back on the alcohol? Do they not? What is actually happening? And I think that's one of the things that's really important. Like 23andMe does that a lot. We ask our customers in the real world setting, how are you using the medications? How are you using therapies? And you find customers are willing to tell you, and in fact, they want to tell you, and it would be so much better to be able to get therapies out faster, but then potentially recall sooner or better understand exactly what are the limitations of a new therapy and really where should it be used.
I mean, a recall is very rare. That's a very high bar within the FDA. They almost never do that.
Well, I think the reality is you should like look at Vioxx. Like I would say without a doubt, there's probably people in this room who wish Vioxx was back on the market. And without a doubt, there was a world where Vioxx worked incredibly well. So could you actually have a really restricted label? Could you actually, and that's to me also where genetics plays in. Where, like, could you actually help define for people? Say, you're somebody with this kind of mutation, you should not use this therapy. Or you're somebody with this mutation, you should use this therapy. And you already see that with a number of medications. But more and more, the more that you have these huge data sets, and the more that you have lots of people being sequenced, you're going to be able to find and fine-tune all these medications. The reality here is most medications don't work effectively for a lot of people.
For everybody.
Hypertension, depression, all these areas. Like everyone in this room, I guarantee, has said, I've taken a medication and it didn't work, or it had a severe adverse event, or it wasn't a great experience. And that's exactly what we need to change. And with the fact that there is so easy, everyone's on Facebook, everyone's online, we should have a distributed network where we're actually capturing all of that data because people care. And when my child has an adverse event to vaccines, which they get all the time, they get massive reactions, I have to fax in, you know, the information about it. So, but we should change that.
So that actually leads to another question, which is the sort of question of like, okay, well then where does all of this data live? And who's the shepherd for it? I mean, you guys collect data and you say in your privacy policy you will share it with law enforcement with a court order, correct?
I mean, we say we will, like the reality, privacy is critical to 23andMe. We will do everything we can, we've said, to resist it. But if we are forced via subpoena, then we would have to do something. We have put up a transparency report. We hired somebody, a chief privacy officer, actually from the government. We're incredibly focused on being transparent about it. So we've had zero requests. We've had zero instances where we've had to return data to the government. So I think the reality is we will do everything we can to fight that.
But if individualized therapies are going on and if you kind of have this dialogue with consumers, where does all that stuff live? Like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, where does that go? And how do I make sure that, you know, my boss who's sitting over there somewhere can't look at it?
I think the reality is people have to get comfortable with the cloud. And I remember well, again, in the internet era of people saying, oh my God, I'm not going to put my credit card information online. Like how could you imagine buying, shopping online? And obviously all of us today shop online.
Yeah, so, but I would guess that a lot of people in this audience have had, you know, their credit cards used when they were not using them.
I think that there's a slight difference with some of the health information versus, like, some of the credit card has, like, finances and the ability for me to get your money has, like, an immediate reward potentially for me. But for me to get your genome or get your health information, what is actually the value there for me? And the fact that there is federal protection now, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that prevents discrimination based on your genome, and the fact that there is now, like, because of affordable care, everyone has to be insured, so you can no longer discriminate. Like, that to me was so revolutionary in terms of how we think about healthcare, and I think it's massively underappreciated in society. The impact of saying everyone has the right to have care, it means that the entire world of discrimination that used to happen regularly cannot happen anymore. And that's so significant for this world.
You know, I want to go back to something that Ann said, because I couldn't agree more about really the notion of responders versus non-responders to drug. I think that's an evolution, the conversation we need to have, because we really look at drugs a little bit in a regulatory process as a one-size-fits-all. And yet, of course, all of us in this room have had an experience where we took a particular therapy, it didn't work for us. That was a lot of the discussion we had, in fact, with Addie, is that it's not going to work for all women. This is not a one-size-fits-all. And in fact, to your point about discovery continuing, phase four is incredibly important work. You know, the approval point doesn't stop discovery on a compound. And in fact, you mentioned alcohol with us. Yeah. So here's a perfect example of really understanding drug development. So you do the large phase three studies, right, in your intended-to-treat population, and you look for signals, the signals that when I put it out into the masses, this is what I might see. You then take those signals and you do challenge studies in healthy volunteers. So in our large phase three studies, about 58% of women characterize themselves as mild to moderate drinkers, right? We didn't monitor their everyday alcohol intake by unit. These were six-month trials. They were in for a long time, many of them out to a year to a year and a half. We looked at particular things. For example, one of our common side effects is sleepiness. So one of the things the FDA asked us to do was a next-day driving impairment study. In healthy volunteers, we looked at that. We saw no next-day driving impairment. Similarly, with alcohol, we did a challenge study in which we took subjects and they drank between 2 to 4 shots of grain alcohol in 10 minutes. Whoa. We dosed them with Addie. Right? But very, very seriously, to recruit volunteers was actually interesting to get people into that study. But this is where, you know, misunderstanding takes place. Mm-hmm. So because of that, and because in those events we did see we saw low blood pressure, we saw dizziness and fainting, in an abundance of caution, when you go out into the market, you say, don't drink. Because we actually need to go back, and we will continue to do the work. So we do, like, what I'll call real-world study we're about to embark on, where you drink, you know, a glass and a half of wine with dinner, you go to bed 3 hours later, you take your Addy as directed, we monitor your vitals. We also are going to do other challenge studies at different thresholds of alcohol intake and see what is that line in which we can anticipate. But you go to market really in a very cautious stance, because that's the responsible thing to do for consumers.
All right, I'm teeing this one up for you because I know you want to say it. Why don't you like the term female Viagra? Because Viagra, after all, having that word associated with your drug, with Addie, that's a multi-billion dollar drug. They've done pretty well.
They have. Here's why. Because women are not on-demand creatures when it comes to sex. Period. In fact, if I did a survey in this room, I bet you would have told me that. And I could have saved Pfizer a lot of money when they were looking at development of Viagra for this condition, because women on the street would have told them. The reason, here's why I don't like it. I get it contextually, right? Could Addie be the same kind of game changer for female sexual health that Viagra was 18 years ago for men? I hope so. I hope it opens the door to a lot of different therapies coming forward. But I think that has promoted the misunderstanding. We've looked for this quick fix. That's not what's happening for women who have this condition. In fact, it's a brain chemistry issue, and we should understand it and look at it in the same way we do for other drugs that work on brain chemistry issues, like antidepressants, for example, where the goal of treatment is a restoration effect to a normal you once knew, not a quick fix. And I think that the term, in fact, the very male-dominated and male kind of conceived sexuality model really held up progress for women finally getting to a first. So thank you for teeing it up.
No problem.
And well, now we get to the point where so far the reviews have been mixed. It works for some people, it does not work for others.
Absolutely.
When you see that sort of out in the marketplace, how do you react?
Absolutely. I want that to be. Nobody is more incented than we are to set realistic expectations. I want to be clear. If the reason a woman has no desire for sex is because she's with the wrong partner, talk to a therapist, never take a drug. That's not going to be the right treatment. I mean, I do want expectations. Not all women will be responders. We don't ever imagine that for any drug. And so I think that even explicitly in our label, we state, because we know from our data, if you do not respond within 8 weeks, you are not going to be a responder. Go off the drug. We go and tell healthcare providers to tell women that, have them back in. If they can't tolerate it, if it doesn't work, get them off the drug. I mean, this is about being responsible and setting expectations with consumers. So I'm delighted when that's out there and the truth is there of what we should expect from medication.
I'm about to turn this over to questions, but I do want to ask you guys, first of all, I hate work-life balance questions because I think if you were two dudes, no one would care or ask you. But I do want to know, as women CEOs, do you think your path is different in what you do because you're women?
I have an answer.
Yeah, you go first.
So I draw a lot of my energy from it. I've got a women's healthcare company with a women's product. So in that regard, it's an advantage. I think it has helped me have conversations, frank conversations with patients affected by the condition we're aiming to treat. But I also realize that I think I'm going to get this right. There's less than 3%. Our industry is behind other industries, to be sure here. And I'm certain that if there's an article about our drug, there will be at least a comment about what color I'm wearing. So look, that's the truth of it. It's both ways, but more often
you are wearing pink.
I am. I'm wearing pink. Mm-hmm. I think that, and that's often there. But I'm very proud. Our company, for example, 76% of our employees are women. I'm very proud of that. And really just proud to be a leader in that position. We have great men, too, wonderful men who are mission-driven for women's issues, but I think it's both ways. I certainly use it more often than not as the inspiration to go out there and get it done.
Mm-hmm. How about you? Does it make a difference?
That's my mom and sister. we're known for our punctuality.
Genetic.
I get the question definitely a lot on this. I feel like I was really raised in a gender neutral household. Like I really didn't, like I always knew I was a girl, but it never really
occurred
to me. This
is not a gender neutral world, however.
Yeah, it never appeared to me that there was a limitation. Like it never, so recognizing, and I guess it was clear, yes, there are more men in certain areas, more women, but to me that was always just a question of time and society evolving and society adapting. And so part of, again, what I say from sometimes with the FDA, it's taught me patience. I also feel like there's a patience that comes with the balance that is happening with both gender and with ethnicity, actually. And I feel like more of the discussion in Silicon Valley has evolved from, oh, men versus women, to like, why isn't there better ethnic representation in all the companies and on boards? And I think it's a question of time. And one of the things I think a lot about is it's our job to actually be here as you are. Like, you're wearing pink, I'm wearing a dress, like as you are, and show, be a role model for the next generation and show there are women CEOs, there are women in biotech, and having an alliance and being supportive and mentoring. Like, I really think for both men and women, it's about mentoring. And I think like 23andMe is just changing our paternity policy because it was not just the women who wanted time off, but it's men who want just as much time off and they want to spend time. And we try to be like, as a leader of the company, we try to be super supportive of both the men and the women. And it would be so odd if it was just like the men staying late at the company, and they'd probably be looked at like, don't you have kids? Like, go home. So I think it's important as a leader to set that tone and that example. And the reality is the only way change comes is when you lead by example. And so that's our job here, is you lead by example. And I'm sure there are lots of people out there who like find it like, oh, there's like women and there's like issues, but it's changing. And we will be part of the change that is helping inspire the next generation. So in 20 years, there is a better balance.
So we nailed it. We now have 15 minutes for questions if you guys want to throw any of those things at them. And it's going to be a little hard to see. Oh, there, that helps.
That was good. Thank you.
There's one back there.
Hi. So I was curious, is it true that 23andMe is focusing more now on how you can actually get involved in drug development yourself? Mm-hmm. And why you wanted to do that as a company versus maybe selling or sharing the data with other pharmaceutical companies?
So when we started the company, the idea in part was, empower the consumer, empower you, the individual, to believe that you can own your genetic data, that you can learn about yourself, that you can actually launch this whole world of preventative action around yourself. But secondly, that, to some of the questions that we said before about FDA, the drug discovery process is so broken, and the fact that the pharma industry is one of the few industries that comes out every year and brags about how much worse they got every single year. So now it's like $2 billion to make a drug, and it was $1 billion, 5 years ago. So we have this hypothesis that if we had so much information, we could really change it and change the drug discovery process. So we originally started working with pharma, and we work with a number of different pharma companies. I think one of the things that we realize is that there is almost a hangover effect from the 2000 era, where there was all these companies that invested massively in genomics, and then they realized, they're like, ugh, this genomics thing, like, we already did that. We tried that, it didn't work, it didn't pan out. So for me to spend so much of my time convincing people that genomics was worthwhile took a lot of effort. And when the opportunity came up to hire Richard Scheller, who ran research and development at Genentech, which has launched a number of incredibly innovative drugs, and he's just a stellar innovator in drug development, and the fact that he wanted to join 23andMe to say, you have the most amazing database of information, you really could revolutionize drug discovery, I mean, why would I say no to that opportunity? And so for us, like, I really want to prove that we can revolutionize drug discovery in almost like that Moneyball kind of moment of like having a human database. Does that actually give us such an edge to be able to do it that much faster and that much more inexpensively?
So do you have, can you tell us how many drugs you have in the pipeline now?
We don't have. I mean, he only joined in I think like April. Yeah, it's a relatively short time frame. That's at the date of it. Like, they're really the team is growing, and they're really enthused about what we can potentially do. So we have more. It was part of raising money. We just raised $115 million, and part of the purpose of building out having a lab where we can actually really accelerate the pace of the discoveries and see. I mean, we would like to prove this out as quickly as possible, obviously.
I used to work in government, and any time that we did investment and it failed, trust me, we were ripped apart. My question, I guess, is as you're talking about trying to empower the consumer more with health, have to speed up the drug trial process, is there capacity within the public to actually accept tremendous failure, especially when you're dealing with something as personal as their health?
I think we need to celebrate failures a lot more. I think the reality is that, and I think, again, this is something that Silicon Valley, I think, does well, but like it's assumed. Like, look at Travis, who started Uber. He failed a bunch of times before that. Like, we should be failing, and things are going to happen. Like, it's not a perfect world. Like, I say with 23andMe all the time, like, we will make mistakes, we will have issues, but the one thing as CEO I can promise is we will always be transparent, and we will always work night and day to rectify if there has been a problem, if there has been a failure. Like, we had a sample mix-up, probably 7 years ago, and it was identified in part because our customers contacted us, said this didn't make sense. Within 24 hours, we identified the plate had been inverted. We were able to rerun everyone. It was a 36-hour problem. We were incredibly transparent with customers about it, gave everyone, the right data. And so for me, part of it is having that level of honesty that we don't live. Like, there's no industry that's a perfect world. But the best thing you can do is be transparent and then make sure that you learn from that every single time.
Has that response, Do you think your response on that has changed since 2013? Like, have you gone through a learning cycle, having gone through that?
I don't know. I still really stand. I mean, I think that people, I mean, even with drugs, like when, like I said, the examples with Advil and with Tylenol, the fact that those things are evolving, I think people need to recognize, like even with your drug, like people need to recognize that there is not a level of perfection in healthcare, that we are still learning. And I think it's really damaging to people that they don't know, like, is cholesterol good? Is it bad? What are you supposed? Bacon now came out as being horrible. Like, is it? I mean, which was somewhat obvious. But is it like, what is it that we're supposed to do? And I think it's much better for people to actually be honest and say, we have a level of certainty here about this, but there's always still this kind of chance, or there's this kind of change. And I think we do that in other industries, but I think in part because, and this goes back to some of your earlier questions about the consumer, like we trust people to have children and to drive cars and to buy guns, but for some reason it's seen as like, you know, potentially taking a medication to control your cholesterol like requires supervision. And I think that's part of it is we have to have this level of honesty with the customers. We don't know that much about health. When you walk in and you take a medication or you're having a surgery, there's a limit to actually what we know. And that's part of the whole purpose of 23andMe is to say, we need to follow, we need to study, we need to actually collect all this data. It's crazy to me that in this world of electronic medical records, that Walmart has so much information about how we shop, but no one has all that information about our health. And actually can track these things. And why isn't it that I can go to my doctor and my doctor says, wow, Anne, based on your behavior and what you do, you're 5 years away from being diabetic. But I can go into Target and they know exactly what I'm going to buy. And they know exactly the fact that my son used to like cars and now he likes Star Wars and he's evolving. They know exactly what I'm going to buy in 3 years. And they're going to market it to me. That same thing should happen in healthcare.
You look like you want to jump in. Or you
look, I fully believe that we can be trusted. This idea that, you know, it requires supervision. I'm completely with Anne on that. The idea that we do all have to accept that it's an imperfect. Drugs are not perfect. They come with risk. And that, you know, the ability is really for you to participate in that decision making and understand that no one thing is a cure-all. No one thing is an easy fix. I think that's the cultural piece of it that we've got to get in sync with, you know, in terms of medication. And look, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, right, is not exactly ripe with consumer trust. That's part of it, right? Is that as an industry, I think it's done a very poor job of instilling that consumer trust. So I so appreciate, you know, what Anne has done to really be a game changer and talk about that. Just truth, you know, there will be mistakes, there is not perfection, but we will always, you know, fully disclose. And to your question even about what do I think when there's information out there that says, you know, Addie isn't all it's cracked up to be. It's not the perfect female Viagra. Well, it's not female Viagra to begin with. And some women are gonna take it and have really material change for their lives, for what they're going through, for the distress of this condition. And others, regrettably, it won't help. But in fact, what I hope it has done is I hope it has opened the door to women having permission to have this conversation and ultimately other companies having interest to invest in this space and bring forth other treatment options because no one thing helps all. You know, I looked at this when I came into it. I said I was a founder of a company that had a male product and men at this point had, you know, more than 20 options for their sexual health. So there was a variety. So the Viagra piece that opened the door to more innovation is a good thing, but we were woefully behind on women.
So one thing I would love to see pharma's, and you just made me think of this while you're talking here, is that you launch a new product, and there's very few companies then that then say, we're going to try to really understand exactly who it works in. Mm-hmm. And it would be so great to say, this is a new product. We'd like to know in 5 years, what are the types of women where it works in? How long does it respond to? Is there a genetic basis of that response? So that over time, you say, you know what? 90% of the people who are taking it have a really positive outcome. And I think it's a tragedy to me, the fact that people are afraid of actually changing, companies are afraid of changing their labels. And so there's not a lot of that post follow-up that's happening, but that should be our goal as a consumer. And to me, that's the whole purpose. Because we, the consumers, do not actually make the purchasing decision, there's not a lot of that kind of like ongoing follow-up that happens. And I think that should be the goal. In 5 years, you should be able to say, this is exactly the type of demographics of the women. This is the types of women that it's working in. There's a genetic basis for it. This is what it looks like. And then we can actually make much better decisions, and there's a much better outcome for the drug, and there's a much higher satisfaction.
More questions? Oh, hello.
How much is the fact that people... Oh, hello. Big pharma. People have a lot of negative views about pharmaceutical companies. So how does that change your challenge? Doesn't it add to it?
How does what? Sorry, say the first part?
The fact that people have such a lack of trust for drug companies.
I think the thing that people don't realize, like at the end of the day, the drug companies are full of people who all have the right intention and want to improve. Like, they spend their life not sitting around thinking about, like, oh, how do we rip these people off? But they spend their time sitting there thinking, how do we actually make a meaningful impact on the world? So it's full of people who are actually doing the right thing. And when everyone in this room is going to have somebody in their life who is sick. And at that moment, you are going to be wanting to have a therapy. And it's not like the therapies just come out of the government or they come out of academia. They come from drug companies. So the drug companies actually have a mission that we have to partner with. And I think part of the problem here is that the system as it exists today doesn't necessarily incentivize for the right kind of outcome. And again, that's my whole point on the consumer side, is that if there was a true efficiency with the consumer having a voice in it, you know, potentially there'd be better efficiency in pricing. Potentially every single drug would have extensive phase 4 follow-up so that we know exactly how it's being used. And every drug would have a genetics that's part of the label so that you would know whether or not you really should take it or whether you shouldn't. And I think so it's a problem to me with the system, but not necessarily, I can't ever blame necessarily the pharmas, because they're doing what actually is in the interest, how the system is set up to do it. And it is full of really good people. I'm always impressed by the people that I meet in pharma.
But I have to follow up on that, though, because we just talked about Viagra. We talked about the millions of options that are out there for, like, erection drugs. All you have to do is watch a live sporting event and see the commercials. And yet, when you go back to, I don't know, chemotherapy drugs or, you know, rheumatological autoimmune drugs, what we're talking about, they're not receiving the same kinds of billions of dollars put into them because the market is there for Viagra. Do you think that that presumption's wrong? I feel like consumers look at this and say, all you want is Viagra and you're not helping me with whatever thing it is that I have.
I would disagree. I think that oncology in particular is an area of great investment. You see a number of even large companies almost skinnying down and focusing uniquely there. So I think that what you see is the consumer-like drugs that get a lot of conversation, and that may shape that perception. Or you see advertising around particular medications that stick with you because you were watching the Super Bowl and had to watch the couple in the bathtub, whatever that may be. But I think that's just a perception issue, and the things that culturally probably are more the basis of conversation. I think they also, you probably have a particular reaction. I found this at least in, you know, being in the field of sex now for some time. People come at that with a point of view. Probably all of us in the room have a particular point of view. So even with our data, it's funny. Some people go, ooh, that sounds good. And they're like, well, I don't know, right? And if it was diabetes or it was something else, which I was not affected by, I would not come to the table with that same point of view.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more. I don't know if you want to get back there. Oh, we're hooked. Okay, sorry.
So, Cindy, I'm wondering about, like, the education process that you went through, because it's a new drug, new to category, and how you spoke to women about the drug and if there were any sort of differences among, like, age range, age groups, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So it surprises people that in the particular condition we treat, it's indiscriminate across the age bands. So our indication is in premenopausal women with the condition, we'll pursue postmenopausal.
Can you define the condition?
It's very long. Generalized acquired hypoactive sexual desire disorder in premenopausal women. What that is basically a lack of interest or desire for sex that has changed. So women who have our condition once knew a different normal. It's changed for them. That change has been persistent. They're bothered by it, and they're interested in seeking treatment. In terms of, you know, just how the conversation, it has been, I have really learned at the hand of patients, and I'm grateful for that, right? When we got into this, when we picked up where others were walking away, women started writing. And one woman in particular wrote, she said, I was in one of the clinical trials. I'm grateful that you picked this up. She was one of those patients where they'd come to her and said, we're walking away from the program, give back your treatment. And she had seen, you know, a real change. And I sat with her and I said, great, she lived outside of D.C., let me meet up with you. And we sat down, I said, tell me your story. And she said, you know, look, I'm the breadwinner in the family. I've raised two beautiful boys. I have a great marriage, but I wait every day for my husband to ask me for a divorce. And I have succeeded in every aspect of my life other than this one. And I watched, I think, what was quintessential woman turning on herself. If only I bought cuter lingerie. If only I read 50 Shades of Grey. If only, if only, if only. And, of course, me, the geek, I said, can I show you something? I open up my laptop, and I'm showing her some of the brain scan studies that have really informed a lot of our understanding of the biological basis of this condition. And I realize as I'm geeking out that I've totally lost her. And I turn to her, and she's just pouring tears. And I think I learned that the validation that comes when we really take a patient experience seriously and when we understand that biology can be at play, that it's multifactorial, really, a lot of conditions, sex in particular, but we have to respect all those components.
Well, we are out of time. You were both fantastic. Thank you so much, Anne Wojcicki, Cindy Whitehead.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.